Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan, and Alex is not with me today. Alex is ridden with some kind of black plague, I believe, so he is not here. But I am not alone. Oh, no, no. I am very happy to be joined by the co-founder and president of the One Shot Podcast Network, James D'Amato. James, thank you for being with us.
Hello, heroes. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Oh, yes, and I am very glad that you were willing to delve down into the caverns of tabletop gaming.
Oh, yeah, I've left a trail of goblins and imps behind me as I've made my way to this conversation room here.
Oh, I hope they didn't give you too much trouble.
Actually, they gave me a lot of helpful advice, not just for how to get here, but in my life in general and with my finances.
Now, when you're dealing with goblins, is that kind of the situation where you don't try to be confrontational right out of the gate? Maybe you try to solve it with words?
Literally any time I am in a situation in games where I am confronted with like an intelligent humanoid foe, I think it is always the most fun to talk to them first, because like in most situations, I know that it's going to come to blows eventually because that's what the plan is for that day, which means you are free to have the wildest conversations.
Right.
There's no stakes. You know you're going to fight, so whatever. And if you don't, it's even better.
It's a great time to talk about philosophy, you know?
Exactly!
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the One Shot Podcast Network. You have quite a few shows going on over there.
Ooh, we do, we do. And it's growing all the time. Like, there are a bunch of shows that we're adding that haven't even hit the air yet. So, yeah, we have a lot of shows that are mostly focused on actual play and interviews right now, though we're adding a lot more discussion programs about game design theory and theory surrounding running games, and also history and psychology in role-playing is going to be coming up.
Ooh.
Yeah, the shows that I'm really excited about us adding are Session Zero, which is going to be run by two licensed psychologists, and they're going to look at the overlap between psychology and gaming. And that's going to stretch from tabletop role-playing to LARP to all sorts of different factors, taking their psychology backgrounds and looking at gaming through that lens. I am so excited to learn from that. And we're adding another show hosted by Daniel Kwan, who is a terrific figure in Toronto's tabletop scene. And he is going to be, along with his co-host, running a show called Asians Represent, where they are looking at the contributions from the Asian community to tabletop role-playing, which, you know, is something that, like, I feel that I only have the faintest idea about. So I am so excited to learn, like, all of the things that I have been missing that may have been right in front of my eyes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think there's just a lot of things you don't think about until somebody brings it to your attention, and then you go, oh.
I mean, and for the longest time, like, when I was in this hobby, the names that were in the interior covers and on the spines of books, like, didn't mean much to me. And really, it's only within the last 5 years of my life that I've really had a concept of the people behind the products that I've been using. So, you know, who knows who's touched my role-playing experience? And like, that's one of the things I love about podcasts, is people taking the time to actually look into these subjects and explain, you know, who made games, why they made the choices they made when they were making them. It's really a fabulous journey.
Absolutely. So how long ago did you get into podcasting, and how long ago did you get into tabletop gaming?
So tabletop gaming started my freshman year of college, which was 2006. So I guess 12 years ago now.
Ooh.
Boy, howdy. But yeah, I hadn't really played. Like, there were one or two times in my life where people tried to get me to play D&D, but I hadn't actually sat down and really committed to a game until I got into college. Mm-hmm. And I got into it because there was a girl who I really liked, who was in this like introductory D&D game. Mm. And one of my buddies was in that game, and I sort of like asked him, like, hey, could you drop out so I could get into your slot so I can, you know, meet this person? And so, you know, like many people, I'm sure I got into Dungeons and Dragons because I wanted to meet people. You know, and it's a great way to do it.
Right, right. You got into D&D to meet a girl.
Exactly, exactly. It's the classic story. Mm. It's everybody's experience.
Yeah. I mean, I started playing video games thinking to myself I would be a real hit with the ladies, but that didn't really work.
Well,
so.
Yeah, and you should have been rolling dice and talking in silly character voices.
Oh, yeah, that's what I should have done. See, I missed out. All right, so that's how you got introduced to role-playing. When did you start podcasting?
I started podcasting 6 years ago. I wasn't doing tabletop podcasting at that time. I was trained as an improviser in Chicago. I went to school at the Second City Conservatory and programs at I.O. And graduated from there. And one of my buddies that I graduated with introduced me to podcasts. And it wasn't too long after we were listening to these shows that we decided, you know, all we really need is a microphone and we can do this. I bought us a microphone and we started recording a improv podcast called The Overshare, which I unfortunately think is no longer available online. But we were doing that improv show for like about 6 months before we got picked up by a slightly larger podcast network that is now defunct called Peaches and Hot Sauce. And when I was on Peaches and Hot Sauce, like after about a year there, my boss at the time, Pat O'Rourke, came to me and said he had been listening to a show called Nerd Poker over on Earwolf.
Yes.
And he knew that I was into role-playing games. So he's like, hey, could you develop a show kind of like Nerd Poker or Peaches and Hot Sauce? So I came up with One Shot, and I came up with it because a lot of the shows at the time were pretty focused on either Dungeons and Dragons or Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And in college, I had been fortunate enough to like get the experience that, oh, there's a lot more to gaming than just like fantasy. Like there are so many genres out there and there are so many games. And at that time, I had probably played like 11 role-playing games. So I didn't have a huge amount of experience, but I definitely thought I was hot shit.
Right.
So I was like, I'm going to start up this show where I do a different game like as often as I can. And that turns out to be like, because I wanted to keep the episodes about an hour long, about once or twice a month, we feature a new game. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing that for 5 years.
Wow. Yeah, you still have me beat because I think I've literally played 2 role-playing games. And probably in about 2 sessions. So there's that. So you have me beat by a long shot. Still kind of trying to wrap my head around 5e. I literally just played 5e for the first time on Wednesday. Just consider that when you're talking to me.
Wow. Okay. So now I need to know more about your experience. So
okay.
So you are, which editions are you?
Many people who might have listened to the show probably are already fully aware of my inexperience because that's kind of how we do the show. Alex has actually been playing role-playing games since he was about 12. And he would always ask me questions, or he wouldn't ask me questions, but he'd try to explain how tabletop gaming worked, and I would just have a giant question mark over my head, and that's why we have a show now. I played 3.5 once. He was the DM. And our team never reconvened, so my ranger is still trapped in a crypt, probably dead now. It's been long enough. Then I had a truncated stint as the GM for Open Legends official live play podcast.
Okay.
So I made my own little fantasy world full of rifts that were taking like cybernetic dinosaurs and stuff into a fantasy realm.
Like you do.
Yeah, exactly. Of course I do. Yeah, exactly. There were French performance artists around. There was lots of interesting stuff. And then just yesterday, or the day before, I played 5e for David Steele, who is doing thing over at Steel Empire, trying to pull off the Malmet heist.
Mm.
That's always fun. But
you are on the precipice of like discovering so many wonderful things. I'm envious of you.
Oh, are you? Are
yeah. I mean, like it was kind of a crazy, like the first game that I played after Dungeons and Dragons was Shadowrun. And, you know, that is essentially just D&D with Blade Runner sort of crammed into it.
Okay.
And then after that, I played Feng Shui, which is an action movie role-playing game. And that game sort of opened my eyes to like, oh, you know, it's not all this one kind of thing. And the mechanics that it used were so vastly different from both Dungeons and Dragons and Shadowrun. Mm. Like it showed me that you can provoke all sorts of different player creativity options based on the mechanic set that you're working with.
Oh,
one of the things that I've like discovered through doing one shot is just like how wide and varied those mechanical interactions are. You know, one of my favorite games to talk about to folks who are just sort of like getting into things and learning about the wider world of role playing is Dread. Dread yes. is a horror game that uses the Jenga tower. Mm-hmm. Which like sounds interesting and neat from the outside, but when you're actually playing it, it amplifies pretty much everything thematically in the game because you're worried about that tower falling over.
Right. Right. It's that anxiety is built into the mechanics.
You know what? I'd say even more than anxiety, it's tension, right? Mm. Because even if you're not, you know, terribly affected by the narrative in Dread, and you're not scared of what's happening, it's like you don't know what's happening. You have no control over it. There's no probability that you can work from like you can in D&D where you know, kind of know, well, I've got this bonus and this is the target that I'm trying to hit. There's a lot more unknown and it's based around physical actions.
Right.
So it's very cool. And that's why that game has translated so well to the territory of romance. With Starcrossed, Alex Roberts' romantic game that uses a Jenga tower to represent people's ability to hold back on their feelings. Starcrossed is two characters who are caught up in a relationship that's forbidden. They both really, really want to be together, but have a really good reason not to be. And it uses this tower, and they do things like reveal personal things about themselves and touch each other intentionally or unintentionally that sort of amplifies their relationship. And if that tower falls over, then the person who knocked it over acts on their feelings. And that, you know, that's how the relationship starts, or maybe that's how the relationship manifests tragically too soon and they miss each other and don't actually get together. But it's a fascinating game using that same like power mechanic. So, you know, that's why I love role-playing games, is like there's so many different ways to do them. And it's so hard to define them as just one particular experience. Mm-hmm. The process of discovering that through doing one shot where, you know, every month or so I try a new game has been amazing.
Now, since we were speaking about, you know, Dread and the idea of, you know, scary games in some way, have you ever played 10 Candles?
Yes, I have played 10 okay. Candles.
I mentioned that because we actually talked to the creator at Boston Festival of Indie Games, and we had him on the show. And I liked the idea of using candles, which are going to be finite anyway, to denote like the idea that time is a factor here in addition to the decisions that you make. Such interesting ways to actually implement new and creative mechanics in order to elicit certain sensations.
One of my favorite games, A Scoundrel in the Deep, is about like somebody who's just wandering through a really relentlessly horrible dungeon, sort of cut off from the plan that they initially had, and you know, confused and lost and scared. And the mechanic is the GM will light a match and describe a danger and then hand the match over to the player. Mm. And the player has until the fire reaches their fingers to describe how they get out of it. Or that's it. They take a negative penalty. It is an intense game. It's like the tension of both Dread and of 10 Candles amplified to 10, because like you could actually get burned.
Yeah,
it's a wild game.
Wow, that's fascinating. So in 5 years, you have, if we're talking about like a game a month or something like that, you have played a pantheon of games by now, I take.
Yes, and those are just the games that are on the record. Like there are plenty of games that I've been playing, you know, off air with with friends and whatnot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, this is the part where I get to basically make you choose your favorite child. What was your favorite game? Like, I know every single one of them is special in their own way, but really, what was your favorite game that you played?
Oh, no, man, that's easy. It's StarCrossed right now. Oh. StarCrossed just came out this year. And for the longest time, my favorite game was Feng Shui because it was kind of the game that set off my love of role playing and showed me the wide possibility with it. But I will say StarCrossed is the best designed role playing game that I have ever played.
Really?
It every single rule in that game leans into a particular type of experience and supports that experience really well. There are a lot of games that I truly, truly love, but I think they are not as carefully designed as StarCrossed is, because you know there are so many games like Dungeons and Dragons, super fun game to play. I like fifth edition quite a bit. It's something that I really like introducing new groups with, but like there are also encumbrance rules in D&D.
Yeah.
And it's like I don't ever play with those or ever feel like I need those, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're there for a particular type of experience that I'm not always looking to have.
Right.
Every rule in StarCrossed always supports the experience that like you are trying to get if you're playing StarCrossed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you follow them, you will have a better time with it.
Right, right. And, you know, there are a lot of RPGs that are out there that might be really mechanics laden, and some people would rather do the real role-playing aspect. So it sounds like StarCrossed really supports that.
If you want a more detached version of play, because like when I play StarCrossed, yeah, I like to lean into everything, go full bleed, talk in character, look into my partner's eyes and whatnot. But there's also, you can have a more detached perspective and describe actions in third person, but you can get invested in it in the way you get invested in a good book, you know?
Hmm.
So it still works even if you pull back and have more of a detached third person perspective rather than a first person perspective where you're really trying to feel your character's emotions.
Right. And I like the idea that romance or a rom-com almost is a setting. You don't usually see that in role-playing games.
There are not enough games that focus on it or have, you know, rules built around it.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, you know, with anything, with role-playing games, you can play any genre and you can impose any genre onto any game. Like,
sure.
You could play... you could take Dungeons and Dragons or GURPS or what have you, and you could put a romance plot in there because
mm-hmm.
then you're just acting it out.
Right.
But games that have romance mechanics, games like Emily Kerbos's Romance Trilogy, Kagamatsu, and StarCrossed, these games like really focus on romance as the thing that you're trying to play out, and they give you rules to support that to make the experience stronger.
Right. So what we need is like Jane Austen's Dungeons and Dragons.
That there is a Jane Austen role-playing game that just kickstarted not too long ago.
Ooh.
It's called Good Society.
That sounds familiar. I probably
Good Society role-playing. Yeah, they did extremely well. It's by two designers from Australia. And the art is incredible. And the playtest packet that I looked over, I haven't actually got a chance to play this, but the playtest packet that I looked over looked really interesting. So I think if you are looking for not just romance, but a game of society and social maneuvering, I think Good Society might be a game for you.
Now, with those games that you were mentioning that focus on romance and the love subplots, are there like romantic rivalries in there so that at least if I'm used to like combat, I can have combat with words and actions?
Oh, absolutely. So in Emily Kerbos's Romance Trilogy, which is actually a compilation of three romantic games that she designed, the game Shooting the Moon is exactly that, about romantic rivalry. And it's designed for either two players or three. In a two-player game, you play either side of a romantic rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And in a three-player game, one player is the object of everyone's affection. And so by the end of the game, like you're all sort of vying for a good outcome for yourself. If you're one of the rivals, obviously you want to win the heart of the beloved. Mm-hmm. And if you're the beloved, you want to, you know, control your own destiny.
Right.
Really, really cool game. So yeah, definitely a lot of options for exploring romantic stuff that would involve, you know, more than just two people. Mm-hmm. And certainly allow you to have that same sort of conflict.
Right. And if I'm really clumsy, the Jenga tower, just like I elbow it when I'm going to get nachos, and then I have to act on my feelings. And like those nachos.
I mean, that's a huge fun part of it, yeah. Too, though. It's like you never know when you might accidentally hit that tower and when getting those nachos.
Absolutely. You know, those nachos can cost you, you know, years of happiness if you turn
the temptation
dancing.
Of nachos, much like the temptation of love. Is too strong.
Yes, that's right. Never underestimate the power of nachos. So I'm getting the impression that you really edge more on the idea of role-playing games with the role-playing acting aspect more than the mechanics.
So it is a mixture of both. Mm-hmm. And I think my favorite games are the ones that use mechanics to underscore those story moments that help you make bigger, more dramatic, more interesting choices through the mechanics. Because Dungeons & Dragons is a really fun game. Most of the mechanics that it's providing are options for you to use in combat. So you're doing a role-playing game. You're sometimes speaking in character if you're mm-hmm. in a particular group and having that role-playing experience. But pretty much everything about that side of it is on you. Now, 5th edition does provide you with character traits and flaws and whatnot. And you can use those to try and earn your inspiration. But really, that's the only role-playing focused mechanic that they have. Everything else is sort of in your court. But right. A game like Dungeon World, you have all of these choices that affect the story. Like when you make a move for your character, it dynamically affects the action in a way that could have emotional impact. And there are moves like bonds that sort of tie you together. And like, even if you pull back to like Apocalypse World, which was the system that Dungeon World is based on, like that game has interpersonal moves like sex moves, where if a character has sex with someone, that character reacts to that relationship and that bond in a particular way.
Hmm.
And that helps drive your story forward.
Oh.
So like, and it like could also give you like, I'm the rager. So I have sex. And after that, like I feel undefeatable and I have an advantage in battle and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
These storytelling moves, these moves that like, well, you have to make connection with this character and make this thing happen to get that mechanical bonus, are going hand in hand with your combat experience or with the experience that you typically associate with a traditional role-playing game like Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really intimidating for me, especially having talked about mechanics for going on 4 years now with Alex, is I figured once I get into a game, really any role-playing game, I'm just going to get lost in the mechanics, and then I'm going to feel sort of inadequate as a player. And luckily, when we just did part one of two for the heist that I'm doing, they're pre-gen characters. So when they asked me which one I wanted to do, I picked the bard. And I pretty much just said, you know what? He's just going to be a bullshit artist. Like, I don't think he's very good in a fight or really anything else. But I'm just going to make it so that he can talk his way out of a paper bag. And I'm just going to do that. And so I just played it that way, and it was a whole lot of fun. Just absolutely trying to wheel and deal my way through every NPC I met, and I found that personally enjoyable and fun. So
yeah.
So that was an entry for me. Yeah,
that's great. Well, that just goes to show you there's no one way to play the game that's more right than another, because there are certainly players out there who get most of their satisfaction out of building the perfect character. They're mechanically sound character. There are others who get their satisfaction out of tactically thinking through different situations and puzzle solving and finding unexpected solutions to, you know, circumnavigate having to spend resources or expose themselves to danger. But like, they're not doing it any more correctly than you are. They're right. just comfortable in their style. And, mm-hmm. you know, your style as a player might not be, oh, I go through 30 books to find the one special feat that I need to make this chain of abilities unbeatable. Right. Your play style might just be like, yeah, I like to talk to NPCs and and lie and have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always felt like there was an over-reliance once upon a time, not as much now, but in traditional role-playing back in the day, there was a real reliance on combat. And I just felt like that was very limiting in terms of what your characters can do. Like, okay, I have come across a situation. Pull out your swords, folks. We're going to go hack and slash our way through this.
I mean, well, that's a factor of a lot of different things, right? Because Dungeons and Dragons specifically, and role-playing generally, because D&D is sort of the progenitor of all of this, have wargaming in their blood. Like, right. This was Dave Arneson adapting war games to include these talking sections where player decisions really mattered. And the rule set that he chose to like put onto that was Gygax's chainmail. So the talking part of the game was something that they were all kind of doing in the Castle Blackmoor game. Mm-hmm. And the thing that like, well, we still need to be fair in resolving these combats, right? So we're going to use chainmail. And, mm-hmm. you know, Gygax and Arneson got together and they sort of like peanut butter and chocolate created D&D. But it wasn't really until, I think, second edition that they first started talking about like, oh, there's this talking part of the game. There's this role-playing aspect to it where individual choices are really the focus. The big rules thing that they put out was, well, these are the rules for combat, and this is how person-to-person combat is resolved.
Right.
So yeah, like, I mean, if you're sensing that it's limiting or feeling like that was stifling, it's just that is the thing that specifically Dungeons & Dragons has always kind of been about and has always been the kind of focus of Dungeons & Dragons. In my opinion, it's not the thing that made D&D special and a standout game, and it's not the reason that role-playing games sprung up around it, but like in a traditional sense, it's like, yeah, the thing that is important to get into player hands is the mechanics of how they affect the world in combat, and everything else is kind of on the group and their particular flavor and type. And what I like about the larger role-playing scene is there are people who are like, well, let's make rules about how we can affect the story specifically, mm-hmm. and we can underscore those role-playing moments and make that experience different.
Yeah, and some ways I feel like the community, especially because there's been such a resurgence of RPGs, it feels like it really went mainstream in the last few years, had a lot to do with seeing people on stream, seeing people in the live play podcasts, and really seeing more of the acting and the performance aspect. And so now I feel like that's sort of something that more RPGs are transmitting out because they realize that that's something that's really desirable. People are actually very engaged with that, watching it and hopefully doing it themselves.
I do think that we're just now kind of hitting the point where streams are affecting role-playing games. Mm. I don't think designers yet have really tapped the potential of actual play and streaming as a specific design element and thought when they're creating games. Mm-hmm. I don't think these story games are being designed because people are desiring those elements yet. I think when they do start getting designed that way, we're going to take notice and you're going to start seeing those games a lot. But I think up till now, those games have mostly been aimed at the audiences that, enjoy storytelling and role-playing the most out of the role-playing experience. The Diana Jones Awards just this year have decided to nominate actual play as one of the things that should be recognized by the Diana Jones Awards. And for those who don't know, the Diana Joneses are kind of the most prestigious award in the role-playing industry. And since the industry's not huge, it's like most prestigious is like kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but it's almost a lifetime achievement award and an innovation award for RPGs. And, you know, this is the year. And after, you know, I have been doing One Shot for 5 years, after Friends at the Table has been around for a number of years, after Critical Role has been around for a number of years, like, this is finally the time where they are sort of standing up and recognizing actual play. And that is the old guard, because like the Diana Joneses is run by a shadowy cabal of different RPG designers who are all of like the older set. So I think we are just now at a time where people are like, yeah, actual play. It's got a really interesting use and effect in the role-playing landscape.
Right, right. Well, you know, sometimes it feels like industry changes take a lot longer than the societal changes. So out here, we'll be like, yeah, this is something we really like. And it takes a long time for people in the industry to adapt to it. Those changes happen fast sometimes.
For sure. And I mean, like Dungeons and Dragons, like Wizards of the Coast D&D division has recognized that a huge part of the audience for the game is people who watch streams and listen to actual play and whatnot. They say that half of the audience is the traditional audience that sort of plays the games, as you would expect. And the other half are people who watch the game. And like, that's a really interesting thing that we're just now dealing with, because for the longest time, it was impossible to export the experience of role-playing. The only way you could get someone to understand role-playing and what it was sitting them down and actually taking the time to play a game with them. And now somebody can, you know, go on YouTube or Twitch and like in an hour, they can go through an experience where they have seen role playing. They understand what it is.
Yes. And I've started to notice that a lot more of like Wizards inner circle, when you see a lot of the people that work for the company now, especially on Dungeons and Dragons, are streamers. They are people that actively play in front of a camera. And so I think that that must have some effect, or at least gives me the nod that that is going to be a focus down the road for them. Don't know how it's going to affect the next issue or anything, but fifth edition's probably around for a while, right? I feel like it is.
I think so. I have not heard anything about a sixth edition, and the release schedule starting for fifth edition was very slow. Like you used to get 3 or 4 books a year back in 3.5, and fifth edition, you know, you maybe get one book a year, and that's certainly started to pick up after Wizards, you know, saw that, oh, there is a real interest in D&D. It still can be a profitable product, and it has this new market to it that we don't fully understand. So the product line surrounding 5e has just really started picking up. So I think it's got some years yet left in it.
Yeah, yeah. My prediction is that you'll see Elder Scrolls 6 before you see 6th edition D&D.
I think that is a fair statement.
And that's a while ways away, too. If in the realm, we'll say in the D&D-esque realm, you know, the high fantasy settings, besides Dungeons and Dragons, have you played any of interest from other developers that really, really stick with you?
Yeah, well, one that's really cool is 13th Age. That is a game that was designed by one of the folks who was behind 3rd edition D&D and one of the folks who was behind 4th edition D&D.
Ooh.
So there's a lot of familiar D&D elements to it. It sort of bridges the gap between, you know, role play story mechanics and miniature combat, rolling dice, a lot of crunchy bits to it. It's fun. It's big. All of the rules in combat are sort of bent towards excitement. And you can, like, if you're the player who just enjoys rolling a bunch of dice and seeing a huge effect out of what you're doing, then it's a game that you might enjoy.
I'm always interested in some of the smaller games because, you know, they should get their time in the spotlight.
Oh, for sure. I agree entirely. One that is, like, sort of adjacent to the fantasy D&D type set would be Phoenix Dawn Command. This is a game that's designed by Keith Baker, who folks might recognize from his work designing the Eberron setting for Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, yes.
It has not showed up in 5th edition yet, but like you probably know it from 3.5 and 4th. But Keith designed a game called Phoenix Dawn Command where the advancement mechanic is dying. You play as a character type called a phoenix, and phoenixes are a special type of like warrior that when they die, they get reborn as a stronger version of themselves. And you can die 7 times before you die permanently. And like the setting of the game, like there is this horrible otherworldly plague made out of nightmares and fear that's spreading throughout the countryside, and like a lot of society has collapsed, and you as these phoenixes have to like figure out a way to push this plague back, and you're like vastly outnumbered and outmaneuvered in some instances. So it's not a question of will you go into this mission and die, it's a question of when will you die in this mission. When is it useful? When should you make that sacrifice? When should you retreat? You get reborn every time the sun rises. So like you could all make a heroic last stand in the dead of night, and your enemies can like strike you down, and then the sun peaks up over the hills, and all of a sudden in a flash of fire, the entire party is reborn as stronger versions of themselves, and they charge once more into battle. It's a really, really cool game with some great ideas, and it's a card-based system, so it is not based on dice rolls. You have a little bit better control over your luck. Like, you decide, well, I'm going to play this lower card now because I want to build up my hand for higher cards later and things like that. It is a very different experience of D&D, but there's a lot of the same trappings are there, and I think could create an intriguing experience for you.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated with the idea that a strategy could be, I'm going to die, but it's going to get better.
Exactly.
that's an interesting idea. The last time I tried playing any kind of game like that, it was Dark Souls, and I was not happy. So,
Phoenix Dawn Command is a little bit different than Dark Souls.
Yeah, so, you get better as you go. You don't lose things. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, see, that sells me right there. I get better, not worse. I'm glad about that. I had one shot to get this right, even if Alex was not in tow, and I think we did okay. James was really great to have on, and I want to make sure that anybody who might be interested in finding out more about the One Shot Podcast Network can go over to oneshotpodcast.com and find all the wonderful projects they have there. As you even heard him say, there are more on the way. And also, while we are at it, I want everyone to be aware that he actually does have a book that is available for pre-order right now, the Ultimate RPG Character Backstory Book, and it is available hopefully at your local bookstores soon, but also at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon. And we are actually going to talk a lot more about that on the next episode, where we get a lot more into the actual character development process and we talk more about the book. But right now, that's something worth considering. Also, since we did mention Dark Souls at the end there, just a little plug that there is going to be a new Attempting to Play tomorrow. Shows what happens when I actually tried playing Dark Souls Remastered. You can imagine how that went. Yeah. And if you want to talk to James about some RPG stuff, because he always likes to talk about it, you can find him on Twitter at OneShotRPG. You can also find us on Twitter. As always, I am at Citanium, Alex is at EXP Limited, and the show is at Delve Podcast. And if you're interested in any of the shows over at One Shot Podcast Network, or if you're interested in Delve or Orbital or anything like that, feel free to head over to the iTunes, the Google Play, any podcast app you happen to use or frequent, And make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Stars are great. We love stars. Put 5 of them in a row. It's a beautiful thing. You know, why leave 4 stars? 5. There's one more star there. You know you want to give that one. That's a great one. And as always, I would be remiss if I didn't say that when you do go over to our website, if you do check us out, please make sure to check out our Patreon. We just recently redid it so that it actually offers things that you might like instead of the silly one where I was wearing a parrot hat. So hopefully that will improve your experience over there. And we're hoping to have more and more actual content for you over on that Patreon. The complete unedited version of this interview will actually be up on Patreon right now when you are listening to it. So you get to hear the whole thing right now if you are a patron, even at the $1 level. Just something to consider. Next week, we are going to be back with more of James D'Amato and more about character development. And, yeah, there might be some more stuff about Snowball. I'm just, fair warning, unicorns, ghosts, Oscar Wilde. Get ready for all of that insanity. And we'll see you on the next one. Goodbye.